It shouldn't be controversial to acknowledge that Canadians get a lot of our popular culture from America. The biggest movies, the most watched TV shows, most of the music that tops the charts here comes from elsewhere. Not everything, obviously. I mean, Drake lives at the number one spot, and Schitt's Creek just won all of the Emmys, basically, by itself. But we do have a well-documented habit of overlooking our own stories in favor of flashier ones from America or even the UK. And that's true even when it comes to things like crime. Quick, name me a famous heist. I doubt the first things that popped into your head were Canadian. And that's a shame, because we actually have a wealth of daring criminals and ingenious thefts to be proud of. Okay, maybe not be proud of. But if we're going to be cheering for anti-heroes in the cops and robbers genre, we have no shortage of homegrown criminal masterminds. So why don't we know their stories? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Jeff Siskind is the executive producer of True North Heists, which is an Audible original, and we cover a world spiraling into chaos all the time, so it's nice to take a few minutes out to talk about famous maple syrup heists.
It is great to be here, Jordan. I'm a big fan of your show, so I'm you know, doubly thrilled.
Well, I'm a fan of some of these stories that you guys told, because we're always looking for Canadian angles on this show, and we love doing true crime, and this is both of that. Why don't you tell us to start? What is True North Heists in general?
So True North Heists tells the stories of some of the wackiest and most audacious bank robberies that this country has ever seen. It covers the gamut. Historically, we talk about Bill Miner, who was Canada's first train robber. We talk about the Boyd Gang, you know, who held up a bunch of banks in Toronto. And what I think is so interesting about it, or that I really learned, was that these robberies are sort of uniquely Canadian, partially in a way that we would think of them. They were all very polite. You know, they had a little bit of showmanship. They said, you know, please and thank you. But they showed a creativity that I think is sort of unique to this country in a way that kind of delighted and inspired that, you know, we have great stories too. Granted, these are kind of criminal stories and not the ones we necessarily celebrate in a heritage moment, but are still super fun and just as delicious as the stories of from anywhere in the world.
We're going to get into some of the specifics of the most audacious of these ones. But first, how did you go about finding the stories themselves? I'd never heard of any of them.
We had a pretty crack team of researchers on this, and we just went trolling. We went looking at Canadian true crime books. There's a lot of blogs. And just looking for stories that had a certain sort of panache and style to them. And that was the bar, is we don't want boring. You know, there are people just go up and they stick up a corner store, but that's not exciting. It's what linked all these stories together was a certain style and kind of a fun to them. And our hope, you know, these are crime stories and we're not advocating that people should go out and rob banks or anything. But the audience at some point, I think listening to this, gets confused about who they're cheering for. And ultimately, these criminals kind of become heroes. And that's what kind of drew us to all these stories, is there's something about what they do that just makes them attractive anti-heroes, I guess.
So give me one example to start with.
I'll tell you my favorite one. And this was just because it was like, it's such a bonkers story. There was a guy named Rory Shane, who in the late 70s decided to rob a bank in probably the wildest way I'd ever heard of. You know, one thing, just to rewind for a moment, one thing I learned on the series is that robbing a bank, certainly in the 70s and 80s, was crazy easy. You just walked in with a note and you could, it was a great way to make money.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way.
Rory Shane, he upped the game. So it's February, it's wintertime in Montreal. Montreal is the bank robbery capital of the world in the 70s and 80s, I also learned. There was, I think, one of those years, there was like 900 robberies reported. Rory, it's wintertime. Him and his girlfriend hire a helicopter to take them on a sightseeing tour, a two-hour sightseeing tour, supposed to go to Quebec City, tour around, you know, old Quebec and come back. They get on the helicopter. Things are looking a little weird because Rory is dressed head to toe in black leather. His girlfriend is dressed head to toe in red leather, and they're carrying two large duffel bags. But, you know, the pilot, slightly suspicious, but, you know, a paying customer is a paying customer in February in Montreal. So they begin to take off. Rory then orders the pilot, he pulls out a gun, and he orders the pilot to land the helicopter at a golf course, which it's February in Montreal, so there's nobody in the golf course, gets out, puts some police decals on the helicopter. The pilot is realizing this is a bad scene. So he gets out of the helicopter. He starts running. Rory, you know, out of the duffel bag, gets his machine gun, starts firing at the pilot, who then, you know, decides to retreat and comes back, gets back into the helicopter, gets handcuffed to the steering yoke. Rory orders him back up. He is pointing where to go with his machine gun, points him towards a suburban bank, lands the helicopter in the parking lot of a suburban Royal Bank of Canada. Rory Shane gets out. People later reported they thought they were watching an action movie in progress because this was so wild. This guy comes out dressed head to toe in black leather, wielding a gun, goes into the Royal Bank, hops the counter, gets $12,000 in a couple of minutes, gets back on the helicopter. They then take on the helicopter, and he orders the driver to land the helicopter at the subway. And he basically gets off the helicopter, escapes into the subway, and is gone. You know, what I love about it was, you know, this is the craziest, most stylish way you could rob a bank. And ultimately, he gets away on the subway. Like, there's something, you know, both unbelievably daring and wacky about the whole thing and so simple. You know, his giant failing, though, was he wasn't wearing gloves, and so his fingerprints were all over the helicopter. And so it didn't take long for the authorities to catch on to him. But it's just, it's that kind of daring and style that kind of linked all these stories together.
How come Canadians don't know these stories, even as, like, kind of legendary capers, the way you just described that one? You know, I feel like I know a dozen American stories of daring thefts.
Well, what is interesting is I think they've just been lost to history, because certainly the ones, you know, from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, what we found were, at that point, these bank robbers were major celebrities. And the newspapers would have circulation wars with each other, where they would try and outdo each other on who could have the exclusive with these celebrities. There was one we dealt with, his nickname Red Ryan. He was in the 20s, and he would rob with a real style and a real charm. Ultimately, got arrested, was sent to the Kingston Pen, got a job in the carpentry shop, and his very first thing that he built in the carpentry shop was a 27-foot ladder that he then used to get over a 25-foot fence. It was a great escape.
Didn't anybody at the prison notice, like, hey, this guy's building a pretty big ladder? Maybe he's planning something?
I would think, but apparently they didn't. The Toronto Star gets a hold of the story and sends a rookie reporter named Ernest Hemingway to go cover it.
Really?
Ernest Hemingway, this is his first story in the Star, was the daring escape of Red Ryan. He coins the nickname Red Ryan and proceeds to write a series of these most incredible articles about this daring guy, you know, on the ladder with a pitchfork, you know, prodding the guards. And he becomes a giant folk hero, so much so that a decade later, Canadian Prime Minister R.B. Bennett is running for re-election, and Red Ryan is back in the prison at that point. Bennett decides his best move is to go and visit Ryan, give him a full pardon so that he can sort of get some of the halo effect. At that point, Ryan is sort of a model prisoner, and the thought is prisoners can be reformed. Ryan says, that's great, thank you very much. He gets out of prison. It doesn't do any good because Bennett doesn't get reelected. Ryan gets a radio show on CFRB because he's such a huge celebrity by that point. And his radio show is talking about prison reform and how he's reformed. There's then, this is where the story becomes less fun and tragic, but there's a robbery where people try and rob a car. And as they're pulling out of the driveway, the owner and his son come out and they shoot the owner and his son. Ryan shows up at police headquarters the next day and he's like, I can help you guys solve that. I can go undercover. Well, it was Ryan that wasn't, he was the one who murdered this innocent person.
Wow.
So I know it's a very long way of answering your question, but the celebrity status that these guys reached, and it was time and time again, was in a way that I couldn't name a bank robber today. I'm sure it happens all the time. But back then, they were celebrities, but for some reason, these celebrity stories have kind of been lost, I guess, as we no longer glamorize crime in the way it once was.
It's interesting that you just mentioned, like, I guess there are bank robbers today. I feel like certainly not at any comparable scale to what used to happen in the past. And that's why these stories are older, because I don't know how you would get away with some of the stuff that that you guys reported on today.
Yeah, and I imagine, you know, again, we're sort of glamorizing crime, which is maybe not great, but I think they're probably not as much fun as they were, because it's probably harder to do. There was sort of a sentiment that people kept talking to us about, that these guys became folk heroes because, you know, certainly during the Great Depression and time after the war, there was a very anti-capitalist feeling against the banks. And so these guys were the ones who were kind of sticking it to the banks and sticking it to the man and kind of on the side of the little guy and doing the thing that everybody kind of fantasized about doing.
So you talked to a lot of the people on both sides of these crimes, including some of the criminals themselves. What are they like now? You know, are they conscious that, you know, this is their claim to fame? Are they contrite about it? Are they sorry?
I wouldn't say sorry. I like, these are the greatest party stories in the world. And these people have been dining out on them for decades. One of my favorite episodes was a guy named Mel Mingo. And Mel lived in Montreal, and he was at a bar on Crescent Street, which a lot of shady people hung out at that point. This was in the 70s as well, when Montreal was not great. And heard that there was this building where millions of dollars of securities went through it every day. And Mel, you know, took us through the story beat by beat of him spending weeks outside the building, gathering intel, figuring out exactly what time the couriers got in and out. He would go in the building, and he even figured out a detail that one of the security guards was easily distracted by well-endowed women. And so he got a woman who was well-endowed to come and distract a security guard. And then he would get on the elevator. And he was like, piece by piece, worked out this perfect plan for this perfect day to ultimately hold up these two people holding millions of dollars in securities. I think it was maybe $60 million in securities by gunpoint and getting off with them. And to hear that told through Mel's mouth was incredible. And he's told the story dozens or hundreds of times by this point, but there was no shame. It was something he's kind of proud of. And there's still, I think there was still $6 million of the securities that the cops never found. And Mel just kind of was like, well, that's a story for another time.
Wow.
These are still victories. And I think Mel talks about, had he put all of that energy towards something legitimate, he would be a much richer man today. I think there was just sort of a glamour in doing what they did, and they did their time. And so they're on the other side of that. And it's sort of a boastful pride.
I'm going to talk to you about some of the things you learned or we can take away from this. But first, I want to know about the maple syrup caper.
Yes. So this was actually probably what prompted us to do the series. The story begins in 2012, where there's an accountant named Michel Gavreau who arrives at the warehouse of the Global Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve. Now, I didn't know what that was. I don't know if you know what that was, but
I know what it sounds like it is.
Yeah, it was exactly. Well, so on a good year, they take all the maple syrup and they hoard it. And on a bad year, they release it so that the prices remain steady. So they have this warehouse that they rented on the outskirts of Montreal that was sort of described to us looking like that end scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they're in the warehouse and it's just, you know, crates and crates and crates forever. This accountant is on a ladder, and once a year or something, he went and he counted the barrels. And he's at a really high point in the ladder, and he's losing his balance, and he grabs onto one of these barrels. These barrels are huge and heavy, but the barrel's empty. And he almost falls to his death, and he's like, what is happening? And so they crack it open, it's empty, and they crack open a few others, and they're not empty, but they have water in them. And they're like, okay, this is weird. So they spend the next couple months doing a full audit of this warehouse, and they discover 9,561 barrels are gone. Now, do you want to guess what the value of 9,561 barrels would be?
You got to tell me, but it's got to be $1 million or more.
$18 million
in maple syrup.
And so they were trying to figure out, like, how does that happen? You know, they called the cops. The cops don't have a maple syrup squad, so the cops don't even know what to do. This is something that once it's gone and once it's eaten, it's, you can't trace where it's from, and the evidence is, like, there's no, how do you solve this?
Where do you even store that amount of maple syrup?
These are all great questions that they had. And, you know, this was one of those ones where it's almost amazing it didn't happen sooner. who they looked at first was this guy who rented them the warehouse. And what this guy realized was that there's millions and millions of dollars of maple syrup. There's a security guard who comes once a day to just kind of check on things and then leaves. And there's a padlock. And that's it. So he basically organizes a full criminal enterprise. He hires about 20 different people. And over the course of a year, at night, they're shipping, you know, barrels out. They're cracking them open. They're pouring them into other barrels that weren't super clean. So there's like some, definitely some health issues with that. They're refilling them with a creek. They're sealing back up and they're putting them back. Eventually the creek freezes over, so they can't do that anymore. So they're like, eh, let's just put them back empty, which is how they got busted. And then they team up with this renegade maple syrup, you know, bandit who says, you know, I don't really care what the global strategic maple syrup reserve does. I'm going to buy black market syrup and sell it to whoever I want. And so he's the fence that sells $18 million in syrup. But just amazing that nobody noticed what they were doing for a year, and so many people knew about it, and they only discovered it by this one accountant, you know, almost falling to his death.
Taking all of the stories that you've reported together, what have you learned if you were going to go and try to pull off a heist? What kind of common themes come in terms of how people get caught? What makes a good caper?
Well, I think, one, I wouldn't be very good at it.
What do you need to be good at it?
Well, I think you need to have a showmanship and probably not value your life a lot, because these things, you know, have an inherent risk to them, particularly as they get big and bold. I'm not a criminal mastermind, and I don't lean towards the criminality, but I think that, like, you know, there certainly was part of it where we're in production, we were sort of joking that, you know, if we really wanted to fund a podcast company, robbing banks would be a great way to do it, because it did seem stupidly easy. And I think that's the genius of all of these things. They all have these audacious ways of doing it, but at the end of the day, they're putting maple syrup on a truck and they're filling it up with water. Like, or they're walking into a bank and putting a gun and saying, give me your money, and walking out a couple minutes later. They all have very, very complicated ways, but the actual act of stealing is stupidly simple. And I think that was part of what I learned is I would think that it would actually be very, very difficult to pull these off, but the actual act of any of these robberies seems remarkably easy. Again, we're not encouraging people to do that, but it's sort of worth noting.
Of course, we're not encouraging people to do that, but you do potentially end up with one of the greatest party stories of all time, as you pointed out.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And certainly a lot of people on the series use this to get their own kind of fame. And we found that, you know, time and time again, it fueled a lot of ego and a showmanship that I think a lot of these guys needed in some way.
Thanks for doing this, Jeff. I really appreciate talking to you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much, Jordan.
Jeff Siskind, executive producer of True North Heists. You can get that right now at audible.ca. That was The Big Story. For more from us, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. You can, of course, talk to us anytime by email. The Big Story Podcast, that's all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. If you're one of our few listeners in the United States, get out and vote, and we'll talk tomorrow.